She eased back into perfect, sure-footed precision. It was Nibiria's turn's movement that tucked Ianthe's arm behind her back, and Nibiria's turn's perfect, precise footwork. It was profoundly weird to see Nibiria's turn's moves restrung in Ianthe Tridentarius's body, but there they were, recreated right down to the way she held her head. Colum moved in for advantage, a high, vertical cut to her naked collarbones. She avoided his move with boyish contempt and countered. Colum had to scramble to meet her. It was only then that it hit home to Gideon what Ianthe had done. The bizarre sight of a necromancer holding a sword, a ghost fighting inside the meat suit of his adept, made it real that Nibiria's was dead, but that he was dead inside Ianthe. It was not that he had taught her how to fight. It was him fighting. There was Nibiria's instant counterstrike. There was Nibiria's gorgeous deflection, the tiny movement knocking Colum's shield away. Normally, Gideon would have been fascinated to watch the Cavalier of the Eighth at work. He was as light on his feet as a feather, and yet his blows were all heavy as lead. But her gaze was locked on Ianthe, only Ianthe, who was moving more Nibiria's than Nibiria's ever could, whose body was agile and lithe and as suprahuman as a wisp. But there was one catch. The sword of the third house must have weighed at least a kilogram, and Nibiria's muscle memory could not quite account for Ianthe's arms. Some power must have been compensating for her body. Her elbow should have been locking like a door. But whatever she was doing to wield that thing, it was just a fraction not good enough. She was sweating. There was a pucker in the middle of that preternaturally calm forehead, a wince in the eyes, the slight drunken lolling of the head that she had suffered from before. As she faded, Colum took the advantage. She shook herself, and he raised his foot and kicked her sword out of her hand. It spun over to the wall where Palamedes had been, and cluttered there miserably, far out of reach. Colum raised his sword. The princess of the third house raised her hand to her mouth, gored a chunk of flesh from the heel of her palm and spat it at him like a missile. Ianthe disappeared beneath a greasy, billowing tent, cellular, fleshy, coated all over with neon yellow bubbles and thin pink film. Colum bounced off this thing as though he had hit a brick wall. He went ass over tea kettle and rolled over and over, only at the last skidding back up to stand, locking himself into position, panting. Where there had been a necromancer, there was instead a semi-transparent dome of skin and subcutaneous fat, baffling to the eye. Nothing loath, Colum charged again, smashing his shield down on it with a bad wet noise like squirk. It was rubbery. It bounced back against him. He gave a mighty slash downward with his sword. The flesh bubble tore and bled, but did not give. Gideon put her hand on her sword to draw it and slipped her fingers into her gauntlet. Thin fingers wrapped around her wrist. When she looked around, Hera was tight-lipped. "Don't go near them," she said. "Don't touch her. Don't think about touching her." Gideon looked around wildly for the sixth house. She found only Camilla, swords sheathed, face impassive. Those watching were doing so in near-embarrassed, breathless silence as Colum circled the horrible skin shield, testing it with slashes, shoving his blade home hard and grunting when the flesh did not give. Then Silas closed his eyes and said quietly, "The necromancer must fight the necromancer." Colum raised his arm for a beautiful downward cross-slice, then jerked back as though he had been stung. He retreated, sword and small shield at the ready, and gritted his teeth. Gideon now knew what leeching felt like, and swore to God she could see the haze in the air and feel the chilly suction as his necromancer began to siphon. "Stop fighting me," said Silas, without opening his eyes. Colum said gruffly, "Don't do it. Don't put me under. Not this time." "Brother Ersht," said his necromancer. If you cannot believe, then for God's sake, obey! Colum made a sound in the back of his throat. Ianthe was visible as a blurred shape behind the yellow-streaked flesh wall. Silas walked forward on light feet, crackles of electricity arcing over his skin, his hands, and laid his palms on the shield. The skin puddled around his fingers, and for a moment Gideon thought it was working. Then the wall sucked his hands inward, ripping and bristling with canine teeth. The shield bit down savagely, and there was blood at Silas's wrists. He cried out and then closed his eyes, the heat pouring off him in waves. Colum went greyer and greyer and stiller, and Silas squeezed his hands into fists. The shield went pop, like a pimple or an eyeball, and fell to the floor in ragged strips and jiggling globs. Silas looked almost surprised to see Ianthe, who was gripping her head in tight-knuckled hands. When Ianthe looked up, her eyes were wild and white again, and she screamed in a voice that required many more vocal cords than she possessed. Silas approached her with hands like hot white murder. Ianthe ducked past him and flung herself down onto one of the still bubbling sheets that had made up her shield. She sunk down into the skin with a splash, peppering the wooden floor with hot yellow fat. The skin blistered and crinkled up on itself like it had been burnt, and then it deliquesced into a viscous puddle, leaving no trace of Ianthe. Silas knelt by the puddle and, silver chains starting to warp and buckle on his perfect white tunic, thrust his hand into it. Colum made a noise as though he had been punched in the gut. A bloodied hand emerged from the puddle, seized Silas by the shoulder, and jerked him in. The ceiling broke apart like a thundercloud, and a torrent of bloody, fatty rain sluiced down on them all. Gideon and Hero gagged and pulled their hoods down over their heads. Two figures tumbled from above, filthy with blood and lymph. Ianthe landed on her feet and delicately shivered off the fetid red soup, more or less unblemished, while Silas fell heavily to earth. There was a faint red mark like a slap on Ianthe's face. She touched her cheek, and it paled into nothing. Silas clambered to his knees, clasped his fingers together, and the feeling of suction popped the pressure in both of Gideon's ears. She saw his power warping around Ianthe now, and she gave a disbelieving laugh. She was breathing hard, almost hyperventilating.
"Octa Kizeron," Ianthe said. "You can't take it faster than I can make it."
"He's trying to drain her," muttered Hero, spellbound. "But he's splitting his focus. He needs to bring Colum back, or..."
Colum, ashen as his name, drunk in movement, numb, had lifted his sword and was moving inexorably toward Ianthe. He backhanded her full across the face with his shield, as though to test her. Ianthe's head snapped back, but she looked more dazed and surprised than hurt or injured. Her breath was coming in stutters. She righted herself like nothing had happened, and the cavalier thrust forward with his blade. She raised her hand and wrapped it around the shining edge like it was nothing. Her hand was bloody, but the blood itself pushed back gracefully, quietly repelling the blade like it was all just so many more fingers. Silas clasped his hands together, and the pressure nearly made Gideon hurl. Colum shook his sword. The blood broke off like shards of glass, and Ianthe staggered, though nobody had touched her. As she lurched away from Colum, the blood on the floor and the walls and the ceiling was drying up, burning into itself as though it had never been. Her eyes were that awful blank white, and she was holding her head and shaking it as though to reposition her brain.
"Stop doing this to me," she was hissing. "Stop it."
Colum turned, and with a liquid, exquisite movement, sliced down across her back. It was a shallow cut. Ianthe did not even seem to notice. The blood bubbled over her pretty yellow robe, and the new gash revealed the wound sucking in on itself and zipping together.
"Listen,"
she was saying.
"Perhaps listen."
Silas slammed his fists on the ground. The air was choked from Ianthe's lungs, her mouth and skin puckered and withered. She stopped, awkward, stiff, eyes bulging in surprise. The remnants of blood rose from the floor as pale smoke, trailing heavenward all around them. For a moment, everything was blanched clean and luminously white. In the middle of all this stood Ianthe, unnaturally still and bent. Blood dripped calmly out of Silas's nose and ears in the blood sweat. Gideon felt Harrow flinch. Ianthe's pallid purple irises had returned, and so had the pupils, though perhaps all a little paler than before. She was aging before their eyes, her skin sloughed off in papery threads, but she was not staring at Silas, who held her as firmly as though he had her clasped in his hands. She was staring, disbelieving, at Colum the Eighth.
"Well, now you are fucked," she announced.
Colum the Eighth's eyes were as liquid black as, before, Ianthe's had been liquid white. He had stopped moving as a human being did. The warrior's economy of movement, the long and lovely lines of someone who had trained with the sword his whole life, the swift-footedness was gone. He now moved like there were six people inside him, and none of those six people had ever been inside a human being before. He sniffed. He craned his head around and kept craning. With an awful crack, his head turned 180 degrees to look impassively at the room behind him. One of the light bulbs screamed, exploded, died in a shower of sparks. The air was very cold. Gideon's breath came as frosty white frills in the sudden darkness, and the remaining light struggled to pierce the gloom. Colum licked his lips with a grey tongue. Particles of bone bounced along the floor. Harrowhark had thrown them in a long overhand arc, and they fell true at Colum's feet. Spikes erupted from the ground, crowding Colum between them, locking him in tight. Colum raised his white-booted foot indifferently and kicked through them. They exploded into dusty, tooth-coloured clouds of calcium. Silas looked up, nearly fetal from the floor. He still glowed like a pearl in a sunbeam, but he'd lost his focus. Ianthe stepped out of his spell disdainfully, flesh plumping, colour coming back to her face, and she itched herself. There were lights beneath Colum the Eighth's skin. Things pushed and slithered along his muscles as he walked, heavy-footed, rocking from side to side. Silas wiped the blood away from his nose and mouth and said calmly,
"Brother Asht, listen to the words of the head of your house."
Colum advanced.
"Come back," said Silas, unruffled. "I bid you return. I bid you return. Colum, I bid you return. I bid you return. I bid you return. I bid, I bid, I bid, I bid. Colum."
The thing that lived in Colum raised Colum's sword and drove the point through Silas Octokizeron's throat. Gideon moved. She heard Harrow shout a warning, but she couldn't help it. She drew her rapier from its scabbard, and she threw herself at the grey thing wearing a person's skin. It was not a cavalier. It did not meet the arc of her sword with a parry. It just clouted her with Colum's shield with a strength no human being ever had. Gideon staggered, very nearly fell, ducked out of the way of a sword gracelessly slammed downward. She took advantage of his movement, got up close, pinned his arm between her body and her sword, and shattered his wrist with a meaty crack. The thing opened its mouth and opened its eyes right up in her face. Its eyeballs were gone. Colum's eyeballs were gone. And now the sockets were mouths ringed with teeth, with little tongues slithering out of them. The tongue in his original mouth extended out, down, wrapping itself around her neck.
"Enough," said Ianthe.
She appeared behind the grey thing that had been Colum. She took its twisted neck in her hands as calmly and easily as though it were an animal, and she tilted it. The neck snapped. Her fingertips dipped inside the skin. The eye-mouths shrilled, and the tongue around Gideon's neck flopped away, and both those mouths dissolved into brackish fluid. The body dropped to the floor. And it was Colm again. Face disfigured, neck on the wrong way, sprawled over the pierced shell of his young, dead uncle. There was no solace in that big, beat-up body, clutched around his necromancers in morbid imitation of the whole of their lives. Neither of them wore white any more. They were stained all the way through, yellow, red, pink. The lights buzzed again dismally. The air cleared. Ianthe was left among the gore looking like a moth, fairy-like. She picked up the hem of her skirts delicately and shook them. The blood and muck came off like it was powder. The Princess of Ida beheld the mess around her. Then she slapped herself very lightly, like you would to wake someone up. "Get it together," she told herself. "You nearly lost that." She turned to Gideon, Camilla, and Harrow, and she said, "There are worse things than myself in this building. Have that one for free." Then she stepped backward into the puddled spray of Silas's blood and disappeared. They were left alone in the room with the quiet, stretched-out corpses of Silas Octocizeron, Colm Asht, and Nibirius Tern, and the low, dreary breathing of Coronabeth Tridentarius, looking like chopped-up jewellery. Gideon lurched toward her, out of desperation to move away from the middle, and what was in it, to move toward the abandoned third twin. Corona looked up at her with tears on her beautiful lashes and eyes swollen from crying. She threw herself into Gideon's arms, and she sobbed silently now, utterly destroyed. Gideon was soothed by the fact that someone in this madhouse was still human enough to cry. "Are you okay? I mean, are you all right?" said Gideon. Corona recoiled from Gideon and looked up at her, her golden hair smeared to her forehead with sweat and tears. "She took Babs," she said, which seemed fair enough. But then Corona started crying again, big tears leaking out of her eyes, her voice thick with misery and self-pity. "And who even cares about Babs? Babs! She could have taken me!"
Chapter 35 They left the lonely twin to her bitter, alien grief. Camilla and Harrow and Gideon stood together out in the hallway, reeling. Gideon was rotating her shoulder in its socket to make sure nothing had graunched out of place, and Harrowhark was flicking gobs of something unspeakable off her sleeves when Camilla said, "The Warden? Where's the Warden?" "I lost track of him during the fight," said Gideon. "I thought he was behind you." Harrow said, "He was, and I was by the door. I saw him only a few minutes ago." "I lost sight of him," Camilla said. "I never lose sight of him." "Slow your roll," said Gideon, with far more assurance than she actually felt. "He's a big boy. He's probably gone to make sure Dulcinea's okay. Harrow says I'm a weenie over Dulcinea." "You are," said Harrow, "a weenie over Dulcinea. But he's 600% weenier than I am, which I still don't get." Camilla looked at her and brushed her dark, slanted fringe out of her eyes. There was something in her gaze starker than impatience. "The Warden," she said, "has been exchanging letters with Dulcinea Septimus for 12 years. He's been a weenie over her. One of the reasons he became the heir of the house was to meet her on even footing. His pursuit of medical science was entirely for her benefit." This turned all the fluids in Gideon's body to ice-cold piss.
She never mentioned him at all," she said stupidly.
"No," said Camilla.
"But she... I mean,
I was spending so much time with her.
Yes, said Camilla.
Oh, God, said Gideon. And he was so nice about it. Oh, my God, why the fuck did he not say anything? She and I weren't...
He asked her to marry him a year ago, said Camilla ruthlessly, some floodgate down now, so that she could spend the rest of her time with someone who cared about her comfort. She refused, but not on the grounds that she didn't like him. And they weren't going to relax imperial rules about necromancers marrying out of house. The letters grew sparser after that, and when he arrived here, she'd moved on. He told me he was glad that she was spending time with someone who made her laugh. 5 people had died that day. It was weird how the small things ballooned out in importance comparatively. The tragedy saturated the stiffening bones and static hearts lying in state at Canaan House. But there was also deep tragedy in the flawed beams holding up their lives. An 8-year-old writing love letters to a terminally ill teenager. A girl falling in love with the beautiful stiff she'd been conceived solely to look after. A foundling chasing the approval of a house disappointed with her immunity to foundling killing gas. Gideon lay on the floor face down and became hysterical. Her necromancer was saying, "None of this makes any sense." "Nope," said Camilla heavily, "but it never has the whole time I've known them both."
"No," said Harrow. "I mean that Dulcinea Septimus twice spoke of Palamedes Sextus to me as a stranger. She told me that she didn't know him well at all, after he had turned down her offer for the siphoning challenge."
Gideon, face down on the dusty ground, moaned, "I want to die." She was nudged with a foot, not unkindly.
"Get up, Griddle."
"Why was I born so attractive?"
"Because everyone would have throttled you within the first 5 minutes otherwise," said her necromancer. Her attention was on Camilla. "Yet why her about-face, if it's all how you say it was? I still don't understand."
"If I did," said the 6th Cavalier restlessly, "my quality of life, my sleep, and my sense of well-being would improve."
"9th, get up! He doesn't hate you. You didn't ruin anything. He and she were always more complicated than that. He never even met her in person until he came here."
Gideon emerged from her prone position and sprang to her feet. Her heart was a dry cinder, but it still seemed ridiculously important that Palamedes Sextus be okay with her. That at the end of this whole world, right before their divine intervention, all the little muddles of their personal lives be sorted out.
"I've got to catch up with him," she said. "Please give me a couple of minutes alone. Harrow, go get my 2-hander. It's in the false bottom of my trunk."
"Your what?" said Harrow, affrighted.
"Cam, please, do me a massive solid here and keep an eye on her. I'm sorry I'm a home wrecker."
Gideon turned and sprinted away. She heard Harrow yell, "Nav!" but paid her no attention. Her rapier swung awkwardly into her hip, and her arm twinged in its socket, and her neck still felt weird, but all she could do was run as hard and as fast as she could to the place where she knew she'd find her last 2 living allies, the sick room where Dulcinea Septimus lay dying. She found the warden standing at the midpoint along the long corridor, staring at the shut door to her room. The hem of his grey robe whispered on the ground, and he seemed lost in thought. Gideon took a breath, which alerted him to her presence. He took off his glasses, wiped the lens with his sleeve, and looked back at her as he perched them back on his long nose. It seemed as though they looked at each other for such a long time. She took a step forward and opened her mouth to say,
"Sextus, I'm sorry."
He folded his fingers together as you would a piece of paper. Her body stopped where it stood, as though steel needles had pierced her hands and her legs. Gideon felt cold all over. She tried to speak, but her tongue cleaved to the roof of her mouth and she tasted blood.
She struggled, an insect pinned to its backing, and he looked at her, cold and dispassionate, unlike himself. Palamedes surveyed his work, and he saw that it was good. Then he opened Dulcinea's door. Gideon tried to flail against her invisible bonds, but her bones felt rigid in her body, like she was just the meat sock around them. Her heart struggled against her inflexible ribcage, her terror rising in her mouth. He smiled, and with that strange alchemy he was made lovely, his grey eyes bright and clear. Palamedes entered the sick room. He did not shut the door. There were soft noises within. Then she heard his voice distinctly. "I wish I had talked to you right at the start." Dulcinea's voice was quiet but audible.
"Why didn't you?"
"I was afraid," he said frankly. "I was stupid. My heart was broken, you see, so it was easier to believe that things had simply changed between us, that Dulcinea Septimus had been trying to spare my feelings, coddling an ignorant child who had tried to save her from something she understood far better than I ever could. I cared about her, and Camilla cared about us. I thought Dulcinea was saving us both the heartache of watching her fail and die during our task." There was silence in the room. He added, "When this started, I was 8, and you, Dulcinea, were 15. My feelings were intense, but for God's sake, of course I understood. I was an infant, and yet I was shown endless tact and sympathy. My feelings were always taken as deadly serious, and I was treated as someone who knew what he was talking about. Does that run in the 7th house?" Gideon could hear the faint smile in Dulcinea's voice.
"I suppose it does. They have been letting young necromancers die for a very, very long time. When you grow up awfully ill, you're used to everyone making those decisions for you and hating it. So you do tend to want to take everyone's feelings as seriously as yours aren't," Palamedes said.
"There are 2 things I want to know."
"You can have more than 2 if you want. I've got all day."
"I don't need more than 2, he said calmly. "The first is, why the 5th?
There was a puzzled pause.
"The 5th?
"The 9th and 8th houses pose the most clear and present danger," he said. "The 9th due to Harrow's sheer ability, the 8th due to how easily they could have outed you. Any slip would have shown an 8th necromancer that you weren't what you claimed. He would only have had to siphon you to know. I even wonder why I'm still walking around, if you don't find that arrogant. But it was the 5th house that scared you."
"I don't..."
"Don't lie to me, please," Dulcinea said.
"I have never lied to any of you."
"Then why?"
A tiny fluttering sigh, like a butterfly coming to rest. Gideon heard her say,
"Well, think about it. Abigail Pent was a mature speaker to the dead. That's no good. It's not insurmountable, but it's a problem. But while that was a factor, it wasn't the reason. That was her hobby."
"Hobby?"
"I didn't think anybody would care about the distant past. But Pent had an unwholesome interest in history. She was interested in all the old things she was finding in the library, in the rooms, letters, notes, pictures, the archaeology of a human life."
"Abigail Pent may have been a necromancer, but she was also a historian, a famous one, I might add. You didn't do your research."
"Oh, I've been kicking myself, believe me. I should have gone and swept the whole place first thing, but I was nostalgic."
"I see."
"Gosh, I'm glad you didn't. I didn't comprehend your mastery of the ghost within the thing, 6th psychometry." There was a sudden tinkling laugh. "I think you ought to be really glad I didn't comprehend that.
Pent by herself gave me such a fright.
And you put the key inside her.
Why? Time, said Dulcinea. I couldn't afford anybody catching me with it. Hiding it in her flesh obscured its traces. I thought you'd find it earlier, honestly. But it gave me time to gum up the lock. Who got rid of that? I thought I'd made it absolutely unusable.
That was the ninth.
That's more than impressive, she said. The Emperor would love to get hold of her. Thank goodness he never will. Well, that's another blow to my ego. If I'd thought the lock could have been broken and the key found, I would have cleaned out the place. I wouldn't have left it to be found. But that's why we're having this conversation now, aren't we? You used your psychometric tricks on the message. If you hadn't gone in there, you never would have known that I'd been in there too. Am I right?
Maybe, said Palamedes. Maybe.
What's your second question?
Gideon struggled again, but she was caught as fast as if the very air around her were glue. Her eyes were streaming from her total inability to blink. She could breathe, and she could listen, and that was it. Her brain was full of sweet fuck-all. Palamedes said, very quietly, "Where is she?" There was no answer. He said, "I repeat, where is she?"
"I thought she and I had come to an understanding," Dulcinea admitted easily. "If she had only told me about you, I could have taken some additional precautions."
"Tell me what you have done," said Palamedes, "with Dulcinea Septimus."
"Oh, she's still here," said the person who wasn't Dulcinea Septimus dismissively. "She came at the Emperor's call, cavalier in tow. What happened to him was an accident. When I boarded her ship, he refused to hear a word of reason, and I had to kill him, which didn't have to happen. Not like that, anyway. Then she and I talked. We are very much alike. I don't mean just in appearance, though that was the case, except in the eyes, as the seventh house is awfully predictable for looks. But our illness. She was very ill, as ill as I was when I first came here. She might have lived out the first few weeks she was here, Sextus, or she mightn't have," he said.
"Then that story about Protesilaus and the seventh house was a lie."
"You're not listening. I never lied," said the voice. "I said that it was a hypothetical, and you all agreed."
"Semantics.
You should have listened more closely. But I never, ever lied. I am from the seventh house, and it was an accident. Anyway, she and I talked. She was a sweet little thing. I really had wanted to do something for her. And afterward, I kept her for the longest time, until someone took out my cavalier. Then I had to get rid of her, quickly. The furnace was the only option. Don't look at me like that. I'm not a monster. Septimus was dead before the shuttle landed at Canaan. She hardly suffered."
There was a very long pause. Palamedes' voice betrayed nothing when he said, "Well, that's something, at least. I suppose we're all to follow now."
"Yes, but this wasn't really about any of you," said the woman in the room with him. "Not personally. I knew that if I ruined his lector plans, killed the heirs and cavaliers to all the other eight houses, I'd draw him back to the system. But I had to do it in a subtle enough way that he wouldn't bring the remaining hands with him. If I had arrived in full force, he'd have turned up on a war footing and sent the lictors to do all the dirty work, like always. This way he's lulled into a false sense of semi-security, I suppose. And he won't even bother coming within Dominicus's domain. He'll sit out there beyond the system, trying to find out what's happening, right where I need him to be. I'll give the King Undying, the Necrolord Prime, the Resurrector, my Lord and Master front row seats as I shatter his houses one by one and find out how many of them it takes before he breaks and crosses over, before he sees what will come when I call. And then I won't have to do anything. It will be too late.
A pause. Why would one of the Emperor's lictors hate him?
Hate him?
The voice of the girl whom Gideon had known as Dulcinea rose high and intent.
Hate him? I have loved that man for 10,000 years. We all loved him, every one of us. We worshipped him like a king, like a god, like a brother.
Her voice dropped, and she sounded very normal and very old.
I don't know why I'm telling you this, you who have been alive for less than a heartbeat, when I have lived past the time when life loses meaning. Thank your lucky stars that none of you became Lictor, Palamedes, Sextus. It is neither life nor death. It is something in between, and nobody should ever ask you to embrace it. Not even him. Especially not him.
I wouldn't have done that to Camilla.
So you know how it happens. Clever boy. I knew you'd all work it out. Eventually. I didn't want to do it either. I didn't want to do it at all. But I was dying. Loveday. She was my cavalier. She and I thought it could make me live. Instead, I've just kept dying all this time. No, you wouldn't have done it, and you're smart not to. You can't do that to somebody's soul. Teacher was nearly demented. Did you know what we did to him? I say we, but he wasn't my project. He was a holy terror. Blame your own house for that. I can't be grateful enough to those second ninnies for killing him and calling for help. He was the only one here who scared me. He couldn't have stopped me, but he might have made things stupid.
Why did Teacher not recognize you?
Perhaps he did, said the woman. It sounded like she was smiling. Who knows what that soul Melange was ever thinking?
There was another pause. She said,
You've taken this much more sensibly than I thought you would. When you're young, you do everything the moment you think about it. For example, I've been thinking about doing this for the last 300 years, but I assumed you would try something silly when you realized she was dead.
I wouldn't ever try to do something silly, Palamedes said lightly. I made the decision to kill you the moment I knew there was no more chance to save her. That's all. She laughed, as clear and as bright as ice. It was arrested midway through by a cough, a deep, sick-sounding cough. But she laughed through it anyway, as though she didn't care.
Oh, don't. Don't.
I just had to buy enough time, he said, to do it slowly enough that you wouldn't notice, to keep you talking. There was another laugh, but this one was punctuated by a big wet cough, too. No laughter followed. She said,
Young Warden of the Sixth House, what have you done?
Tied the noose, said Palamedes Sextus. You gave me the rope. You have severe blood cancer, just as Dulcinea did. Advanced as hers was when she died. Static, because the Lictor process begins radical cell renewal at the point of absorption. All this time we've been talking. I've been taking stock of everything that's wrong with you. Your bacterial lung infection, the neoplasms in your skeletal structure, and I've pushed them along. You've been in a terrific amount of pain for the last myriad. I hope that pain is nothing to what your own body's about to do to you, Lictor.
You're going to die spewing your own lungs out of your nostrils, having failed at the finish line because you couldn't help but prattle about why you killed innocent people, as though your reasons were interesting. This is for the fifth and the fourth, for everyone who's died, directly or indirectly, due to you. And, most personally, this is for Dulcinea Septimus. The coughing didn't stop. Not Dulcinea sounded impressed, but not particularly worried.
Oh, it's going to take a great deal more than that. You know what I am, and you know what I can do.
Yes, said Palamedes. I also know you must have studied radical thanagetic fission, so you know what happens when a necromancer disperses their entire reserve of thanagy very, very quickly.
What?
Said the woman. He raised his voice. Gideon, he called out. Tell Camilla. He stopped. Ah, never mind. She knows what to do. The sick room exploded into white fire, and the bonds pinning Gideon snapped. She fell hard against the wall and spun, drunkenly, lurching back down the corridor as Palamedes Sextus made everything burn. There was no heat, but Gideon sprinted away from that cold white death without bothering to spare a glance behind as though flames were licking at her heels. There was another enormous crack and a boom! The ceiling shook wide showers of plaster dust down on her head as she threw herself bodily through a doorway. She ran for her life down the long corridors, past ancient portraits and crumbling statues, the grave goods of the tomb of Canaan House, the mechanisms of this feeble, shitty machine crumbling as Palamedes Sextus became a god-killing star. Gideon fell to her knees in the atrium before the dried-up fountain with its dried-up skeleton and his soggy towels. She put her forehead to the lip of the fountain's marble and pressed a dent into herself, still listening to the muffled sounds of destruction behind her. She pressed as though sheer surface contact alone would allow her to get off the ride. How long she did that for, how hard she pressed, and how long she huddled, she did not know. Her mouth was tight with wanting to cry, but her eyes were dry as salt. Years later, lifetimes later, there was movement at the entrance of the atrium she had flung herself through. Gideon turned her head. White steam poured from the hole. Within the steam stood a woman. Her fawn-coloured curls sadly sizzled to nothing, her deep blue eyes like electromagnetic radiation. Huge wounds exposed her bones and the bright pink meat inside her arms and her neck and her legs, and those wounds were sewing themselves up even as Gideon watched. She had wrapped herself in the bloodied white sheet that had covered her sickbed, and she was standing upright as though it was the easiest thing in the world. Her face was old, lineless and old, older than the rot of the whole of Canaan. The woman Gideon had kind of had the hots for held a gleaming rapier. She was barefoot. She leaned in the smoking doorway and turned away, and she began to cough. She spasmed, retched, clung to the frame for support. With a great asphyxiating bellow, she vomited what looked like most of a lung, studded all over with malformed bronchi with wobbling purple barbs and whole fingernails, onto the ground in front of them. It went splat. She groaned, closed those terrible blue eyes and pushed herself to stand. Blood dripped down her chin. She opened her eyes again. "My name is Kitherea the First," she said, "Lictor of the Great Resurrection, the seventh saint to serve the King Undying. I am a necromancer, and I am a cavalier. I am the vengeance of the 10 billion. I have come back home to kill the Emperor and burn his houses. And Gideon the Ninth." She walked toward Gideon, and she raised her sword. She smiled. "This begins with you."
Chapter 36. Camilla hit the advancing lictor like the wrath of the Emperor. She crashed into her from the side, her two knives flashing like signal lamps in the sunlit hall. Dulcinea Kithareya staggered, flung up a parry, gave ground. She needed distance to bring her rapier to bear, but Camilla denied it to her. Every step she fell back, the cavalier pushed forward, attacking so fast and with such ferocity, Gideon could hardly see the individual strikes. For a second or two, she thought Kithareya was meeting the blows with a bare hand, until she saw that a shank of bone had sprouted from the backs of her knuckles. Camilla Hecht off the leash was like light moving across water. She punched her knives into the lictor's guard over and over and over. Kithareya met them ably, but such was Camilla's speed and perfect hate that she could only hope to block the thunderstorm of blows. She could not even begin to push back against them. This gave Gideon time to stand, to ready her sword and slide her gauntlet home, biting the straps tight with her teeth. It was a relief to know she would never have to tell Camilla that her necromancer had died. She was already fighting as though her heart had exploded. "Stop it," said Kithareya. Camilla did not hear her. She drove past the lictor's guard and found her blade trapped in a thicket of spines that had evolved from the offhand spur of bone. The spines, flexing like snakes, began to curl over the guard, past her hand onto her wrist. Scarcely missing a beat, she stepped in and headbutted Kithareya in the face. The lictor's head snapped back, but no blood showed. She laughed thickly, hoarse. Camilla's body jerked, still pinned by the tangle of bones around her hand. Her other knife fell from slack fingers to clatter on the floor. Her skin seemed to ripple and take on a greyish tinge. She began to wither. As Gideon sized up the best angle to join the fray, a bleached, skeletal hand emerged from behind Kithareya and grabbed her face. Another hand gripped her sword arm at the wrist. Over Gideon's shoulder, the skeleton in the fountain began to stir. Herohark stood at the top of the stairs, hands full of white particles, her skull-painted face as hard and merciless as morning. She flung them out before her like she was sowing a field. From each grain of bone a perfectly formed skeleton arose, a huge angular mass jostling and crowding on the stairs, and they poured out in single formation to rush the lictor one by one. She went under in a sea of bone. Camilla hauled herself away from the rushing, grinding ocean of Hera's mindless dead, clutching her knives more firmly in her recovering hands. The muscles in her arms were visibly springing back into shape. Gideon advanced, heart in her throat, moving to take Camilla's place.
"Leave it!" barked her necromancer. "Nav, here!"
Six more skeletons sprang to her call. They were unstrapping something from Harrow's back. It was Gideon's longsword, shining and heavy and sharp. She unbuckled her scabbard and let the black rapier fall, shook her gauntlet off next to it, and gave them both a private prayer of thanksgiving for services rendered, and she caught her sword by the hilt as it fell toward her. She wrapped her hands around its grip and hefted its old familiar weight. The squirming pile of skeletons exploded outward, and so did the floor. Bricks and tiles and splinters of wood scythed across the atrium like shrapnel. Gideon threw herself behind the fountain. Camilla dived behind an old sofa, and Hera wrapped herself in a hard white cocoon. Skeletons tumbled through the air like morbid rag dolls, bone shrapnel pinging off every surface. Kithareya the First emerged from the clusterfuck, coughing into the back of her hand, looking rumpled but entirely whole. From the hole emerged one long, over-jointed leg, then another, and another. A fretwork of bones, a net, a lace of them, long stingers of teeth, a nesting body, a construct so big that it turned one's bowels into an icebox. The hulking construct that had killed Isaac Tetris filled the room behind its mistress, stretching itself out and expanding, pulverizing a wall and a staircase as it emerged. Its great
bone head lolled and loomed above them, mask-like, with its hideous moulded lips and squinted shut eyes. But now this benighted vision stood before its natural predator, the reverend daughter of the ninth house. As yet more skeletons jerked and clambered upward from their fallen comrades, Gideon got up, dusted herself off, and found Harrow standing in a pool of osseous dust and facing the construct with a hot-eyed, half-delighted anticipation. Without even thinking about it, her body moved to take her rightful place in front of her necromancer, sword held ready. "This is the thing that killed Isaac," said Gideon urgently. The enormous construct was still trying to wriggle one leg free from the floor, which would have been funny if it hadn't been so terrible. "Sextus? Dead." Hera's mouth briefly ruckled. "A necromancer alone can't bring that down, Griddle. That's regenerating bone." "I'm not running, Harrow." "Of course we're not running," said Harrowhark disdainfully. "I said a necromancer alone. I have you. We bring hell." "Harrow? Harrow, Dulcinea's a lictor, a real one." "Then we're all dead, Nav. But let's bring hell first," said Harrow. Gideon looked over her shoulder at her and caught the reverend daughter's smile. There was blood sweat coming out of her left ear, but her smile was long and sweet and beautiful. Gideon found herself smiling back so hard her mouth hurt. Her adept said, "I'll keep it off you. Nav, show them what the ninth house does." Gideon lifted her sword. The construct worked itself free of its last confines of masonry and rotted wood and heaved before them, flexing itself like a butterfly. "We do bones, motherfucker," she said. Her arms were whole again. Her most beloved and true companion, her plain two-hander, unadorned and perfect, smashed through tendrils and teeth like a jackhammer drill. Stinging flails of bone met her blade and exploded into grey foam as she stood her ground and pummeled them with great swinging arcs of good cold ninth house steel. With Hera there, suddenly it was easy, and her horror of the monster turned to the ferocious joy of vengeance. Long years of warfare meant that they each knew exactly where the other would stand, every arc of a sword, every jostling scapula. No hole in the other's defences went unshielded. They had never fought together before, but they had always fought, and they could work in and around each other without a second's thought. Gideon pushed for space. She forced a path, step by careful step, toward the centre of the construct. A tentacle lashed out at her leg. She sliced it open on the downswing and danced away from a stiff whip of molars aimed straight at her heart. Behind her, Harrow took it. It trembled into its component parts, then became a dust of teeth, which settled into a glue that stuck wobbling tendrils together so they broke themselves into pieces trying to smash away. What Harrow did not take, Gideon struck down. She struck its spines with the mad fury and sudden belief that if she just hit and hit and hit accurately enough and hard enough and well enough, she could rewrite time and save Isaac and Jean-Marie, save Abigail, save Magnus. But the size of the thing defied thought, and every strike created shrapnel. Harrow was doing something, shielding her somehow. The air was a hail of sharp particles that ought to have shredded her skin, and yet none of them seemed to reach her. Even so, the whiteout of pinging, ricocheting chips made it hard to see her target. From the corner of her eye, she saw Camilla running through a blizzard of teeth and spines and swinging bone lappets with both knives crossed in front of her chest. Then she was gone, lost to view. Gideon ploughed through a veil of flimsy bone shafts. They were under the bulk of the construct now. Six more skeletons sprang to life and formed a perimeter. These were pillars without legs, thrust through the floor, with the big plated arms and bone-wadded shoulders of the construct in the response room. They grappled great breadths of the construct's tendrils to themselves, and in the clearing between their backs, Harrow flexed her fingers together. She shook finger bones out of her sleeves and slapped the trembling phalanges between her hands like clay. Gideon was busy shearing off questing tentacles that snaked past the skeleton guard and went for her necromancer, catching only a confused glimpse of the slim rosary of knuckles that Hero was looping around her arm. Then Hero flung it upward like a whip, and it punched straight through the monster's midsection, burying itself somewhere deep. She barked at Gideon, "Get clear!" Two of the skeleton pillars, still hugging tangled bunches of bone, bowed apart to make a path. Gideon pulled her hood down over the exposed skin of her face as she squeezed through the gap and staggered clear, away from the nightmare of splintering fibulae and tibiae. But before she could find her footing, Kithareia the First leapt from her place of ambush. She was utterly beautiful and entirely terrible, whole, unhurt, untouched by anything that had happened to her. The wounds from Palamedes's last spell seemed to have vanished as if they'd never been made. It was like she wasn't even made of flesh. A memory flashed up through the haze of adrenaline. "Do I look like I'm in the queendom of my power?" The lictor's rapier thrust whipped out like a fang, like a ribbon. Gideon knocked the stupid fucking thing aside with her two-hander and turned the momentum into an overhead strike. Kithareia raised her free hand, grabbed the heavy blade, and held it still. A thin trickle of scarlet ran from the base of her thumb down the inside of her skinny wrist. Behind them, the construct shook and swayed and thrashed with whatever the hell Hera was doing to it, and Kithareia's eyes locked on Gideon's. "I meant it," she said earnestly. "You were wonderful. You would have made that little nun such a cavalier. I almost wish you'd been mine." "You couldn't fucking afford me," said Gideon. She stepped away and wrenched her sword upward, pulling Kithareia's arm up with it, closed the gap in a hurry, and kicked the lictor's legs out beneath her. Kithareia lost her grip and collapsed into the bone litter strewn across the atrium floor. She coughed and winked at Gideon, and the scattered bones rose up and closed around her like waves, hiding from her sight. From above came a terrible, muffled bellow, a lowing forced through pursed lips. The construct was howling. It tried to surge forward, but the movement kept getting arrested in mid-jerk, as though pinned to the floor. Its tendrils slapped and drove against the ground, tilling up billowing clouds of wood pulp and carpet fragments. The thing gave a frustrated final push and overbalanced, then came down hard on the floor right where her necromancer had been. There was an agonizing crash as the fountain shattered under its weight. Gideon's heart was in her throat, but there was the dusty black figure emerging from the wreckage, ropes of teeth wrapped around her wrists where she had jerked the thing to the ground, a vanguard of skeletons swatting tendrils away from her. Gideon fought her way toward her blindly, clipping off strands and trailing chains of bones as she waded her way to Harrowhark. The construct still pursued her, its legs scrabbling to find purchase as the floor buckled and quaked beneath it, sharpened beaks of bone bearing down on her adept. Hera was forced to split her focus between fending them off and keeping her hands on the reins holding the construct to earth, blood shining on her forehead with the strain. Gideon arrived just in time to plant herself in front of her necromancer and smash a drilling lappet to shards.
"I need to be inside you!"
Hera bellowed over the din.
"Okay, you're not even trying," said Gideon.
Her necromancer said,
"It's all I can do to pin it in place, so you need to finish it for me. Breach the legs. I will show you exactly where, and then I can keep it quiet for a while."
"Seriously? How?"
"You'll see," said Hera grimly. "I apologize, Nav. Get ready to move."
The construct crooned in its chains. The central rod that Hera had somehow awled through its trunk was bowing dangerously.
Gideon dove back into the affray of joint and gristle with her sword scything before her and, just as in the response room, felt another presence slide into her mind like a knife into a pool of water. Her vision blurred out and something said in the back of her mind,
"On your right, eye level."
It wasn't a voice precisely, but it was Harrowhark. Gideon pivoted right, longsword held high. The first leg of the construct loomed before her, a weighty breadth of impenetrable bone. But the back of her mind told her,
"Wrong! Inch higher! Pierce!"
Gideon re-hefted the weight of her sword in her hands, steadied the pommel with the butt of one palm, and thrust it home. The bone was thinner here. Across her softened sight, a light fizzed in and out of vision, the exact same corona of light that had happened 1,000 years ago, 100,000, a myriad of myriads, inside the first trial chamber. She pulled her sword free and the leg buckled. Half a dozen tendrils came after her. They would have given her an interesting array of new air holes for speed, but a skeleton staggered out of the darkness and took most of the blows, jawbone crushed into powder as a tendril lashed open its skull. Another skeleton lurched in where its comrade had died, but this one dashed past Gideon, over to the glimmering wound she had carved into the leg, and it thrust its arm into the gash. Then it melted. Gideon had a few seconds to watch as it sludged into shining silvery white bone matter. With a little sizzle of evil-smelling steam, it shrouded the wound and the bottom of the leg in a lahar of hot bone gunge. She tore her gaze away to skid beneath the heaving torso of the beast, narrowly dodging another few desperate tendrils, cutting her way through a damp nest of them as they unfurled and regrew themselves like the coils of a razor-sharp plant. The leg closest to her had found purchase on the floor with its dainty, sharp-capped foot, so much like the leg of an arachnid, and seemed to be in the process of levering the whole thing upright. The back of her head said, "It's above you." Gideon slipped her grip down the handle of her sword, her forearm alarmed with the effort, tip wavering as the leg shifted and hesitated above her. The back of her head said, "Now!" This one was harder. She didn't have as much purchase. Gideon rammed her sword upward, getting a grip on the pommel and shoving into the limb again as plates of bones splintered overhead and dried flakes of marrow spun down like confetti. The leg tumbled down like a cut tendon. Yet another skeleton appeared next to her and, as she withdrew the sword, plunged into the shining gap. It too dissolved into the hot, foul muck that slid inside the construct's body and enrobed the rest of the leg, dripping down into the floor, cooling rapidly. The hard shine of it and the suppressed agony of triumph in the back of Gideon's head made her eyes water, and she was filled with a weird pride that was all her own. Holy shit! Perpetual bone! Hero had actually cracked it! She was too busy admiring her necromancer to catch the thick rope of vertebrae that looped around her waist and cinched tight. The connection in her mind stuttered and disappeared. Then her vision sharpened, rendering everything happening to her in bloody clarity. Before Gideon could say, "Oh my fucking word," she was plucked off her feet, hoisted upward, and flung bodily into the air. For one vertigo-inducing moment, she was above the battlefield. She sailed past the huge mask-like face of the bone construct, a thick coating of regenerating bones seeping down its legs in rivulets, free-falling, with an aerial view as Camilla danced through the chaos toward the calm and fragile figure of Kitherea the First, who stood watching her approach. Gideon tried to twist in the air. If she could just contrive to hit a window rather than the wall. She was caught with a force that jangled her teeth in her mouth. A spindly pillar of skeletal arms had risen up from the maelstrom to stop her in mid-career, 100 bone fingers scoring bloody ribbons over her back, but she was not splattered against the wall, which was the main thing.
The pillar of arms was destroyed by a long sweeping blow from one of the construct's innumerable bone whips, and she fell to earth again, gravity arrested by the hands helpfully piling themselves up to reduce her fall to terrible from obituary. She landed in a pile next to her necromancer, and her knee went crunch.
"I have bested my father," said Hero to nobody, staring upward at nothing, alight with fierce and untrammeled triumph. They were both lying supine on a pile of what felt like feet. "I have bested my father and my grandmother, every single necromancer ever taught by my house, every necromancer who has ever touched a skeleton. Did you see me? Did you behold me, Griddle?" This was all said somewhat thickly, through pink and bloodied teeth, before Hero smugly passed out. The dust was clearing. The construct could not move. It was making low, plaintive grunts as it thrashed in its half-coffin of regenerating ash. With its tentacles, it picked and smashed at the bone cocoons on its back legs, but as soon as it broke some off, the stuff simply crumbled back into being. Now that it was concentrating so completely on itself, Gideon could find the Cavalier of the Sixth. Camilla, as she'd seen from above, had caught up with Kitherea the First. She had one hand in the lictor's singed curls, dragging her head back. The other hand pressed a knife against the smaller woman's throat. This would have been a commanding position, except that the knife blade was quivering in place. Its edge creased the pale skin, but it hadn't drawn blood, even though Camilla seemed to be leaning on it as hard as she could. Whatever terrible force was holding the knife at bay was also slowly peeling the skin from the Cavalier of the Sixth's hand. "You're a nice girl," the lictor said. "I had a nice girl as a cavalier, too. Once. She died for me. What can you do?"
Camilla said nothing. Her face was slick with sweat and blood. Her crop of dark, blunt-cut hair was powdered grey with bone. Kitherea looked faintly amused by the blade that was a finger's breadth away from being buried in her jugular. She drawled,
"Is this meant to kill me? Give me time?"